Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 14, delivered on October 1, 2009. The title of this lecture is Problems with Basic Present and Future Values.
Today, Problems with Basic Present and Future Values. In this lecture, I'm just going to take you through some essential problems. Here's how we do it. Here's the question. Here's how you attack it. Always remember, your formula, your basic formula is that the future value will equal of a lump sum will equal the present value of that lump sum times 1 plus the periodic interest rate to the number of periods. Now, you can use this for both present and future value problems. If you want, you can write a version of this where the present value is the object on the left. The present value would be the future value over 1 plus r to the nth. So that would be for calculating present value. Again, you could calculate present values with one formula. Just do a little algebra or arithmetic at the end. Now, or you can use PV equals FV divided by the quantity 1 plus R to the N. Now, another representation of this, probably good on a calculator if you're comfortable with the negative exponent. Present value is the future value times the quantity 1 plus R to the negative N. Just remember to put in your negative on the exponent after you key in the exponent number, because that's the way most calculators still work. Has to do with the difference between a binary and a unary operation. But there you go. There's what you need to do the problems. There's what you need to do the problems. Now, there will be one little trick we'll do for a certain problem here in a few minutes, but let's try this one. You invest $500 in an account that pays 8% annual interest compounded quarterly. How much will you have in ten years? Now, always with these problems, always, the first thing that you're going to want to do is to lay out the parameters of the formula. There's future value, there's present value, there's R, and there's N. And first thing you have to do is say, okay, once you've gotten the list of the parameters, is, okay, do I know the future value here, or do I know the now value? And in this case, I know what? Do I know the future? Yeah, I know the now. Yes, I know the now. Because it says, you invest $500. That assumes, well, we're going to do it now. All right, I'm sorry. It is the future value we don't know. Now, the periodic interest rate, it's 8% per year. And we're compounding quarterly. So that'd be a 4 down there. Now, don't do this calculation at this point. Just key it into your calculator this way. Here's why. Because if you have to do something, if it comes out to be some kind of a repeating decimal, you round it and then put it in, you're going to get errors, and they get worse with more time involved. Here we got 10 years. It could get to be a little bit serious. With the exponent, though, the N, do the calculation. In this case, it's 10 years, and we're compounding four times a year, so there would be 40 compoundings total. Do that one. And then it's nothing but a matter of putting in what we know and solving for what we don't know in this problem. So in this one, we have the future value equals the present value, which is $500 times 1 plus, and now we're going to have 0.08 over 4. And again, just put it in that way. Don't do, well, 0.08 over 4, I can calculate that. Just do it the way I'm saying. And also watch it. Don't put in the full percent. Put in the decimal version. The bad thing is that if you use the financial keys, that the calculator wants you to put in the percent, which is a really kind of disjointed thing. But anyway, to the 40th power. Here in the exponent, you do actually get the calculation done before you do it. The reason for that is because if you try to do a multiplication and an exponent, unless you remember to put the multiplication in parentheses, you get the problem all kinds of wrong, because it'll do the exponent on the first one and then times the result of the whole calculation by the second one. So it's better to just do that total number of periods before you do the exponent calculation. So now we just... it's basically just lock and load. And you crank it through, and you're going to get 500 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.08 divided by 4, close parenthesis, y to the x 40. And you get $1,104.02. Make absolutely sure you can do this. You get exactly my number. Because, okay, now if you're if you come up with a number and I come up with a number and I'm grading the exam, whose number is right? That's not a rocket science question, son. Mine is. Okay, so just make sure you're doing this if you can. If you got your calculator, make sure you're getting... to about, you can get a little off. I noticed that some calculators, interestingly enough, will have about a penny, 2 pennies off sometimes with these. I got, what the hell did I get? Don't get old. Just shoot yourself by the time you get to my age. 110402. God, I couldn't remember that number that long, really? 110402. Is that exactly what you got? No. What'd you get?
Mine had more decimals still.
Oh, stop it. It's dollars and cents. Round it, fool. No, it's to the exact penny. Because they're not going to give you pieces of pennies at the bank. They won't. They actually will carry more decimals in their computer system. And there's actually a reason for that with certain... It can get complicated, but if... never mind. But anyway, that's a basic... future value, finding a future value problem. Now let's take this one. How much would you have to put in to a savings account that pays 7.25% annual interest compounded monthly, to have $1,500 in 8 years? Okay, now again, just you've got your FV, your PV, your R, and your N. And then you just, in this case, Is it the present value or the future value I know? Which do I know, the now amount or the future amount?
Future.
Yeah, I know the future amount because I want to have $1,500 in the bank and I don't know the present value. The R is 0.0725 over monthly 12, and you leave it like that to put into the formula and let the calculator do it. And I'm going to say something else here about that in a second here. But and it's quarterly compounding, 8 years, 12, oh no, it's monthly compounding, I'm sorry. 8 years times 12 months per year, so you've got a total of 96 months that this is going to ride. 96 compounding periods. And now this is a present value formula, so I'm just going to put it in this way into the most sophisticated of the formulas. I'm going to have say something here. Okay. Now the present value, PV, is going to be the future value, $1,500 times 1 plus 0.0725 over 12, closing the parentheses off, to the negative 96th power. Now here's the deal. And this is something I've said in all kinds of different fields. It's not even just with calculators. When you do these, run it as a single calculation. No equal signs along the way, except at the end. Get to the habit of doing that, because hitting the equal sign or stopping and writing down a number, that's a bad thing, and then trying to go back in. First of all, that's going to slow you down. Second, it's a source of a possible mistake. Run it as a single blast on your calculator. And as I walk through this calculation, I would be doing 1500 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.0725 divided by 12, close parenthesis, y to the x, and in this case, 96, and then hit the pause neg button. Remember, hit the plus minus button after the exponent on the BAs. Otherwise, it will look at you and give you a wrong answer. And I get, well, what do you get?
841.31.
$841.31. The present value. Now for some reality checks on these. As I had mentioned before, and I'm just emphasizing it again here, these problems, if you make a mistake, you'll get something. Like, for example, if you get a negative number, that's a good sign that you made a mistake. If you get infinity, that's a good indication you got a wrong answer. Go ahead.
I got
841. 31? Did you round, or did you just run it as a single straight calculation? I'm just testing your ass. It is a 31 there. My God. 841.31. See, I did that just to see if you were watching how, because it's really easy to. Okay. I so suck at arithmetic. I have screwed up more generations. God, no wonder there are Sarah Palins in this world. Shouldn't be that way. Okay, now that I have made an asshole out of myself, no, but really a reality check on these just to make sure. Look, a present value should come out to be a number lower than the future value. So if you get a number that's bigger, there's a big clue, and it sounds like I'm being stupid. No, that's actually, you can make a stupid mistake, and if you know what it should look like, that gives you an idea that you've made a mistake and you should go back and and check things again. Are you planning to have children with a woman someday? Well, here's the deal. You look in the nursery, and the lady, the nurse says, that's yours. And in there is Godzilla. Now, you might say, okay, that's cool. Ugly ass baby, but what the... Or you might say, no, no, no. Check the records, lady. Well, not surprisingly, she... Well, yes, that one belongs to Mrs. Godzilla. I'm sorry, yours is over there. And then you look over there, and of course, you know, it's even an uglier baby. But... You know, just do a quick reality check on these. It's so easy to make a mistake. And I did that just so you could see how easy mistakes are to make. Let me show you something kind of cool here. This is the effective yield one. I could ask about on the exam. Now, the effective yield, essentially, the question would be in a problem, and I'll do this one over here that I had with the future value. The question would be, what would be the interest rate? So I wouldn't have to do, in this first one, when I did 500 times 1 plus 0.08 over 4 to the 40th, what would be the interest rate that I would use so I could just do 500 times 1 plus that interest rate to the 10th power? In other words, the effective yield, the interest rate that is the same as the compounded quarterly. And here's how you do it. It's actually a really easy calculation. Just remember it. All you do is to get an effective yield, all you do is just say 1 plus 0.08 over 4 to the 4th power. This thing is about had it. This to the 4th power. And then you'll want to take off minus 1 and then times it by 100 to turn it into a percentage. Be sure you do that. I mean, it's really easy to get it. And where the hell did I put my calculator? There it is. Okay. Now what I'm going to do here is I'm just going to do that real quick. 1 plus 0.084, 0.08 divided by 4 in parentheses, y to the x, 4th power, minus 1 times 100. And I get, the answer that I get here is 8.24%. And there's another one where it'll be a good reality check. It should not be huge. It should be just a little more than what you started with. 8% is what we started with. Here, it was compounded quarterly. The effective comes out to be 8.24%. Okay, you follow with this? Now, here's a very extremely cool part of this. Watch. Sometimes this is useful, quite useful. Let me get some more decimals on that thing. Actually, if you could just read it off to me. Give me about... going to need 6 decimals on it. Watch what happens if I do 500 times 1 plus 0.082. What's the next? What's after that? Did you? 43216. And how many years was it? 10 years? Do that on your calculator. See what you get. Spank me. The effective yield, that's what I was telling you, the effective yield essentially takes away the need to do the compoundings. Now the kicker would be, where this would be really useful is if you had a whole series of calculations with the same interest rate and the same compounding periods, it would save you a step because if you got the effective yield, then you could just store that, and then you could just pop it to the different number of years over and over again. You wouldn't have to worry about the compoundings dividing by and raising to the multiple and all that. It would just be a simple, straight calculation from there. Like I said, that's where it would be really a useful thing. Also, interestingly enough, statutory law indicates that there are requirements on revealing in certain financial transactions, not just a stated interest rate, but also the effective rate. What is the effect of compounding on the rate that you are paying or the rate that you are getting? Now, one last thing here. You know, you're probably thinking to yourself, how could this be any more fun than we already have it? Here's the thing. Look at this. You put $300 into an account and in 5 years you had $400 in the account. You know compounding was quarterly, but you don't know the annual interest rate. You see, and we're going to say, find it. Now, here's the deal with that. You see, this is the window onto a world of financial information that we use and need. And it has to do with the term yield in its most important sense, internal rate of return. All those things where we have the financial numbers, dollar values and all that, but what we don't have is what we really want to know, which is how much interest this is making us. What's the yield on it, on an investment? So this is just a very primitive problem, and you can do this on your calculator, but I will caution that unless you have a real fancy calculator, you'll have to remember something from fancy arithmetic. So here's the deal. Watch. Future value. What? $400 equals $300, the present value, times 1 plus the R, which I don't know, over the D, the number of compoundings per period that I do know, all to the, well, let's see, 5 years, quarterly to the 20th power. So we have an unknown hiding inside of an exponential, which is not a nice place for it. We can't just take that exponential through and all that. We got to deal with it, get a little bit more butch with it. So what we're going to do is this. We're going to take 400 divided by 300, do plain old algebra from the old days, stripping off layer by layer, pulling this thing down until we get at this thing right here. 400 divided by 300 equals 1 plus R over 4 to the 20th. Now, I'm going to leave that there like that for a minute, okay? You can do that on your calculator. Don't try to impress me by saying, that's 1.333. No, don't do that. Just leave it for a second. The real problem that I've got here is that 20th power up there. I can take the 20th root of each side, But I am betting that most of you, except for you with those rocket science calculators, can't do roots above 2 or 3. It's not on your calculator. But of course, the 20th root is nothing but to the 1/20th power. If I raise both sides to the 1/20th power, I've got 400 over 300 to the 1/20th power. And this is really, really easy to do. It really is. All you do is take 400, whoops, open parentheses, 400 divided by 300, or 4 divided by 3 if you want to be fancy. Close the parentheses, hit Y to the X, and then hit the 20 button. Just key in 20, and then hit the reciprocal button, 1 over X. That little button right there takes precedence over anything. It will take whatever you just put in, and it'll flip it. That 1 over X button will. Now, were you ever taught how to do the essentially roots this way? It's really easy to do them this way once you get the hang of it. You just take, look, I'm just going to take 400 over 300 to the 1/20th power. So I just say, open parentheses, 400 divided by 300, close parentheses. That way it knows to do that division first, okay? Knows to do, and then you say, okay, raise it to the power. Your calculator says, okay. No, it doesn't. I mean, that's disgraceful for a cat. And you hit 20, and then you hit this flip button, 1 over X. It'll just flip 1/20 over and turn into 0.05 right there on the spot. And then you hit equals. What do you get? It should be a very small number. Don't round it. Just let it hold in your calculator, okay? But what does it come out to be? What? You're making me get up off this knee. Blood's flowing back down my hind leg. Now that I get over here. 400 divided by 300 equals. I want you to make sure that you can do this, okay? Just do it. Just humor me. 400 divided by 300. And then I'm going to raise that to the 20th. 1 over X, and it gets to be 1.0 what? Something like. It's going to be a small number, a number just barely above 1. Because you're raising it, you're taking essentially a 20th root of it. Now, subtract 1. See, I'm after this R. I'm after this R. So I've got it down so that my calculator has spit out to me 1.0, what was it? 1 what? 4, blah, blah, blah. Don't write it down and then key it back in. Just leave it there. And then I'm going to subtract 1. So I get 0.0144. And then multiply by 4. Minus the 1. And then to get this R over 4 to give me R, I just times by 4. If you do that, what do you get? Give me 2 decimal places. Oh, 5.80. You have just found the yield on a 5-year instrument that requires an investment of $300 and pays you $400 in 5 years. Jeez, these seats. You just found the yield. That's how you do it. It's just a little bit of algebra, but you can actually derive the interest rate that's buried in there with your calculator, and just by knowing that taking the 20th root is the same as raising something to the 1/20th power. I'll put one of these on that practice set that I'll give you this weekend for the weekend to play with, and it'll give you a feel for how to do these. If you get the hang of these, It's not really hard to go on and extend. It's these basics with the machinery of how the numbers work and the feel of what numbers should look like. In this case, is this a reasonable answer? Well, if you got an interest rate that was 786%, you'd know that probably you've gotten something wrong. And that's one of the nice things, as I've said before, when you do something wrong with these kinds of calculations, they usually are things blow up in your face. Yeah, this looks about right. 5 years, throw that kind of money in. Now, at this point, maybe you wouldn't get that, be that comfortable with it, but after you've done some of these, you begin to know what looks right and what looks wrong. Yeah, about 6% is what you'd need for 5 years to run up from 300 to 400. Yeah, that sounds about right. About right. And again, you're either going to be pretty much on the money or you're going to blow that dog right out the back door. Or you're going to transcribe two numbers like I did there and make an ass of yourself. But anyway. Okay, those are the kinds of present value problems on the first exam. And now let me do a little review for it, that exam with you. I'm not going to go through a huge amount, but I am definitely going to give you a heads up. And then you can ask me some questions, too. No, not personal questions, please, really. That's for my autobiography. First section will be 10 multiple choice. Or multiple guess, if that's your thing. A couple of them... Well, what was that? Did someone hit the bell? I was going to say, it sounds like the dinner bell. Where the hell was I? Oh, okay. 10 multiple choice questions. A few of them might be true and false. And they will be wide ranging. Some of them could be numerical. Some of them could be more knowledge based. Think it through. Okay. Let me see if I can think of one that would. I've got the exam. I could put it up on the overhead here so you could see it. Oh, yeah, there you go. Put it on your Facebook account this weekend, teacher. And by the way, stop hitting my Facebook. No, I don't want to be your friend.
Just accept it.
I don't accept them, and then they just sit there, and they keep bothering me, although some of those, I don't recognize them, and they really are hot. But anyway. And what's really weird is the Twitter. Have any of you hit my Twitter account, Pulp Economics? Did you see some of the people who are following it, their pictures? I think it's three of them. The picture is of an ass. Well, no, it's not. It's nice. Oh. Why do you get off track? Please, stay on track here. Okay, here's one. Fixed the coefficient of variation of net income can never be less than the coefficient of variation of sales. True or false? The coefficient of variation of net income can never be less than the coefficient of variation of sales. It's true. I meant true. No, because the coefficient of variation of sales, the coefficient of variation of net income, after net income, what do you get? Variable costs. Do they affect the CV? Yes or no? No. Then you might or might not have fixed costs. If you don't have fixed costs, then operating CV would be the same as sales CV. If you do have fixed costs, then operating CV would be larger. Okay? We're there. So now, the only way that the CV at the operating line could be the same, not less, but at least the same as sales, is if there are no fixed costs. So let's work it down. Now, if you have interest, then what's going to happen there is that that will blow your CV upward. So you would have to have no interest for the CV at the EBT to be the same as sales. Otherwise, it will be larger at the EBT than it is at sales. And then you have income taxes. And at best, those will not change the CV. But you notice, did you notice that problem that the taxes actually did affect the CV a little bit at the bottom line? Did you catch that? And it was because it was a little bit, part of it was variable, but part of it wasn't. The two lowest you didn't pay any tax on. But anyway, that's not going to reduce CV. So there is no question that the CV at the net income line will never be smaller. It's possible that it would be the same if there are no fixed costs, no interest, and exactly proportional taxes. But it could never be less. That's a tough question. And that would be the worst I would do. Now here's another one. A little bit lighter. Okay. ABC Corporation has a beta of 1.20. Which of the following is correct? ABC Corporation has 120% of the risk of the market portfolio. Is that true or false? Is that correct?
What was their beta?
1.20.
Yeah.
No. That's not risk. Okay, let's go on. You'll see. The first one is a beta of 1.20 would indicate that ABC has 120% of the risk of the market portfolio. That's not true. ABC Corporation has 120% of the diversifiable risk of the market portfolio. ABC will pay 120% of what you'd earn on the market portfolio. No. ABC has 120% of the risk, non-diversifiable risk of the market portfolio. Oh, there it is! Well, bring home the turnips, Martha. We're going to have dinner tonight. Yeah. What the hell did that mean? I've got to stop drinking coffee all night. Okay, so you see, those are the kinds of questions. Now, some of them will be, don't think too hard on some of them. Some of them are kind of like, I'm putting in some no-brainers just to stop you from overheating your brain. Now, that's the first part, 10 questions. The second part of the exam is a matching. I will give you 5 terms and on the right. Now, you have to match those with 6 definitions or explanations. That's right, 6. You're pawing. 6 on the other side. Okay, so you can't do a process of elimination. But it's just going to be a term and then basically one of those will be sort of like a definition or a good description of it. Not necessarily a definition, but a good description of it. Then there's going to be a math calculation section. My goal here, finance, there's plenty of math we do in finance. It can't be the end-all, be-all of one of these, but it'll be there. And I've told you, as far as financial information you would need for a certain kind of problem, I suppose I should just say a coefficient of variation problem or a ratios problem, it will be on the web Sunday night. I'll put the information up there. You don't have to do anything with it. You can just come in cold and do it right there. Do you remember doing those CVs? Were they really easy and fast to do, just like that, finger snap? And you're like, oh, hell no. But if you feel butch, if you feel lucky, you can do it in class, or you can take that financial information and say, I wonder what he could ask me. I might say, well, calculate CV of sales. Calculate operating leverage. I might say, just calculate the net income CV. I could ask a lot of different things. I will ask on the exam for only one or two things. But that means that you, if you do it before the exam, you're probably going to have to calculate four or five CVs just to make sure you're covered on the one I'm looking for or the couple I'd be looking for. And it's up or down, right or wrong. You get it close or you don't get it close. Now, I'm going to also, on the exam, do some present value stuff. These are actually no-brainers. Most of the time, I mean, those are one place where you can just nail the questions. I'm going to do one of those like I did on quiz two. Remember where that first one where you had the columns and you had to do sort of like the puzzle to put back the... You're shaking, you don't remember that? Oh, I know, but those are... Did you see after I did, showed you how to do them, they're not nearly as bad as trying to feel your way in the dark. Sort of like after you read those cheat guides for World of Warcraft or something like that, it's a lot easier than when you go in there and you're getting your ass kicked around. But once you see how it's done, you'll have one of those just very similar to that, where there will just be some of the numbers missing and you just have to fill in the ones that are missing. My quizzes are always a very good guide to what I do on the exams. Same format, just basically I'm lazy, so I copy and paste. No, that's not quite it, but I mean, that's a secret, though, as far as profs go. I mean, copy and paste it saves a lot of time. And then, I don't know. Oh, yeah, there will be some kind of a ratios problem, a couple of ratios. But I'm not going to ask you for, like, every ratio. I might ask you, okay, give me current and burn and ROA, something like that. Not tons of ratios. Because as you're doing ratios, it's as you do more of them, there's more of a likelihood that you're going to make a mistake, especially in an exam environment. I'm trying to test your ability, not your bullheadedness to get the problems done. Okay, now the last part of the exam is where just five short answers. And when I say short answer, it's a complete sentence. You don't go on and on, but you answer it in complete sentence. And don't write in text language to me. Darn it. Don't say, I say, why is this? And then you write B, C. No, don't do that. Or WTF. Definitely don't do that. let me give you an example. I give you this statement. Explain the relationship between risk and return. And your answer would be... Oh, I love it when you talk like that to me. Dinner at Denny's tonight. That's all you need to say. Now that's actually, you're saying, no, wait a minute. That's not even a complete sentence. WTF. In that case, you've given it to me, though. I mean, that's what I'm looking for. And the logic here is that in business, and I'm speaking as someone who does dinners and has all kinds of these friendly chats and backslapping sessions with executives all the time. And they talk about this communication gap. And they're always bitching about these young people. They don't ever answer you in a complete sentence. And they never answer what I want them to. I'm going to make sure that when you go out there, you shut their pie holes up. You give them what they want. A complete sentence, you hit the point, and then you move on. And if they want more information, they know how to get a hold of you. Okay? So say a complete sentence to me and then just be done with it. Walk away and do something else. Now, as far as those short answers go, again, I'll say, give me the relationship or explain or something along that line. You write one sentence in a complete sentence. Don't say ever, I believe, I think, I feel. That is so high school. We don't care what you think, believe, or feel. We want to know what you know, okay? So that's just a warning to you here. It's so that you don't get your ass eaten off the first time you do something like that as an answer to a real CEO. Your turn. Ask me. I haven't told you everything about the exam. That's not my job. You can ask me, and I'll answer questions. Go ahead. Oh, hell no, a 4x6 card. Push it. Well, that's okay. You're allowed to push it. No. Yeah, go ahead. Yes. Yeah. Yes, but here's a rule. I don't know if I mentioned this. Last year, there was this young man. He had done his notes, tight paragraph on a regular piece of paper in Word, and then he had reduced it down with a copier until it was just like fuzz on a card. And then during the exam, he holds his hand up and he asks me if I can read what he's got there. Get away, God! I mean, I can't even read the damn menu at Denny's anymore. Okay. Yeah, but both sides. But just make it legible, okay? And this is one of the powers. And this is, first of all, any financial person has a finance handbook. And I expect you to have one, too, the next time I see you. But you've got one. If you need a formula, you're going to reach up there. And part of the process of making up a good note card is learning the material. You're not going to have time to be prowling that note card. What the hell is that? But so the note card is partly a confidence builder and partly it's a study guide for you. It's not going to really help you that much. It'll help you in a crisis if you have a brain fart and you can't remember something. That's one of its great, but it's also a great study guide for you and it preps you for the exam. That's why I do them. Besides which, like I said, every good financial analyst, hell, I've got all kinds of books of formulas. Some of them, I don't even know what the formulas are for. But, okay, any other questions? Go ahead. Here's the rule. When I write a test, I take my own test. I should finish the test in no more than half the time I expect you to finish it in. Okay? So when I wrote this test the first time, it took me almost just shy, about 38 minutes, almost 40 minutes for me to take it. I'm giving you 60 minutes for this test, so that meant it was too long. That was why I had to change what I did was I dropped the number of short answers down, and I pared down the number of matching. And then I took it again. I came in at exactly 30 minutes. That's a 60-minute test. You should be able to kill it in 60 minutes. You probably will have a few extra minutes there. You might finish it in 55. Take the time to go back through and make sure you haven't made some dumb mistake. But the problem is, of course, if you make a mistake like that, it's going to be impossible to see it. But I do appreciate that. You'll have enough time to finish it. I make sure of that. You have twice as much time as I do. Okay, yeah.
What's another example of like a matching term?
Operating leverage. See, and then you would look through the list and you see this cryptic thing. CV of operating income minus CV of sales. That might be close. Or I might say one like this. Remember I covered a brief amount about Federal Reserve. Okay, I might say 7 governors. Well, that's the board of the Federal Reserve. Okay, the board of the Federal Reserve. By the way, a multiple choice question, just so let me give you one more. I might give you a 1-year discount treasury bill has a price of $940. The yield is ABCD. Always E is none of the above. So keep in mind that just because you don't get an answer that's ABC or D, that doesn't mean you've got it wrong. Also, and this is one unfortunate thing, I'll figure out, I know the ways that you could get the problem wrong, calculate it wrong, so those will be answers that would be available to you. Yeah.
Could you repeat that one, your discount T-bill as yield of?
No, your discount T-bill is let me put it this way. A discount T-bill is selling at $940, 1-year discount T-bill. What's the yield? And it would be 9.65, 4.28% interest, all that. Go ahead.
You take questions from, like, articles you had to read online?
One.
At least one. One will be there. Can't tell you where it'll show up. It will be there somewhere. Guaranteed. Other questions? Go ahead. I don't think I did. Okay, there will be 4 large, but remember they could have several parts to them. Several parts to them. 4 blocks, 1, 2, 3, 4, but there might be 2A, 2B, 2C, so it's not a good guide right there. Now, present value, future value, that would be one problem, and I'd have you calculate some different things based upon some initial information. Okay? Other questions?
You say the best way to study would be to go through the book and read all 8 chapters, or go through the lecture?
You are out of your mind to do it that way. Here's the thing. I'll never ask you something on a test that's in the book that I haven't at least mentioned in class. I never would do that to you. I mean, that's just not how I play it. Your first and foremost, you get through those notes. Go back to the podcast, because you'll be surprised at how sucky notes can be sometimes. You go back and you say, wow, I didn't even write that. Where is that in my notes? Then you match that up with what's in the book, okay? Then you go back to the back and you look in the problems in the chapters and see where, not all the problems I give you material on. There are a lot of problems in the back of the chapters that, wait a minute, we didn't cover that. That's right. I don't have all the time in the world. There's things that I prioritize. So you go back there and see if you can find some problems. Look at the problems from the quizzes. So your study guides very much are your notes and your quizzes. And then where those correlate with the book. Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that. That book, that's not just there as a potted plant, but it's not there for you to find some mystical information. I mean, I'm so good, you obviously don't need a book. Okay? You need the book. It's not like you're going to find anything in there that was not in class. Other things. Rock and roll, people. I'll see you next week.